From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is the Capital Notes podcast for Friday, January 21st.
Yes?
This is an unusual podcast. It's late on a Friday afternoon, and I'll explain where we are in just a moment. I'm John Myers from KQED. There's Anthony York from the Los Angeles Times.
Good morning.
Sort of. And Juliet Williams, you all know her from the Associated Press, sitting to my side. We have one microphone today, so hi, Juliet.
Good afternoon.
See, there you are. And it is a Friday afternoon by the time you get this. We are sitting, should we have full confessional here?
Sure.
Okay. We are sitting at the bar of the Hotel Shattuck in Berkeley, California. And why are we here?
Because we're members of the liberal media elite.
Ah, indeed, indeed. That got a rousing laugh here at the bar. No, we're here because this is the quadrennial. This weekend is the, every 4 years. Quadrennial, is that right?
Quadrennial,
yeah. The quadrennial event of the UC Berkeley Institute of Governmental Studies, where they do a post-mortem on the governor's race. Who, why'd you win, why'd you lose, and on and on and on and on. And so we have sat through part of it so far, and kind of dull.
Well, we're missing the most important show, the secrets that everyone wanted to hear.
Explain what happened.
We're from Meg Whitman, and no one from Meg Whitman's campaign agreed to come. So, you know, all the looming questions, did she know about the housekeeper? Why did they do what they did? We don't get to find the answers.
Yeah, so which has led us to sit here at the bar during an intermission and
cry in our whiskey.
In yours, and opine. So this will be a shorter podcast than other ones, but, you know, that's such is life. We want to make sure we got some kind of podcast out there. I figured we could talk just quickly about what's been going on at the Capitol this week, and then maybe just about this conference and some of the post-mortem stuff that we all think about, since people who listen to this podcast follow the governor's race. So at the Capitol this week, the seas are getting rougher, I would say, with the governor and his budget. Anthony agrees, but seems slightly skeptical. Why is that?
Well, I think the focus of the opposition now has come from the fringe right. I think we can call them that with all due deference and respect. The taxpayer groups within, but really the core of the opposition has come from cities who have balked at the governor's proposal to eliminate the redevelopment agencies, which get about $5 billion, roughly, in property tax revenue every year. And so we saw the governor today, or this week, address the League of Cities and essentially defend his plan to, in the words of the cities, annihilate the redevelopment agencies and say, hey, and his basic take was, hey, if you guys don't like that plan, that's fine. Come up with a better idea and tell me where to save that $1.7 billion. And that's sort of the crux of the Brown argument. Hey, here's my best ideas about how to close this budget gap. The dollar figure is $25 billion. Every dollar in cuts that you guys don't like that I've suggested, find for me someplace else. And so, and that's the challenge, and that's the political fight the governor is going to be dealing with.
I thought it was interesting that he went to the League of Cities event, because, I mean, a lot of politicians would not have done it. I mean, you know, and I think it helped sell his point, because it, you know, we all know symbolism in politics is important. And the symbolism of, I'm going to go tell them the same thing I tell anybody, even though they hate me, about this particular plan. I mean, there is important symbolism there.
Absolutely, and that's how this governor is showing himself to be, like, night and day from the previous governor, Schwarzenegger, because he just went in there and faced the crowd and sort of charmed them with his repartee. And
jokes about Linda Ronstadt,
yeah,
jokes,
I mean,
about his age.
And saying that y'all look hungry to me. I mean, they laughed, they applauded him. I think they gave him a standing ovation at the end. Of course, then they came out afterward and slammed everything that he proposed, but he got quite a warm reception, and I think his message that he's giving is one that Dems have tried to do not as effectively with Republicans for a few years. Like, all right, you don't like this budget plan, where is yours?
It seems to me safe to say that if this experience is unnerving him or rattling him or worrying him, he doesn't show it. I mean, he seems to be fairly serene, I think, about, you know, this is the plan, these are the choices, what can I do?
Yeah, and he sees it as a process, which it is. It's a negotiation. It's going to take a while. It's hearing everyone out. And he seems to have a real, I don't know if talent is the right word for it, but he recognizes that everyone wants to feel like they've been heard. And so he's giving them that deference.
What? Okay, so let's just cut to one of the chases here of this. That was the joke for you, Anthony, with your chaser here at the bar. Did I imply that you were drinking at the bar? We're just sitting at the bar.
We're sitting here.
But let's cut to the chase here about one thing, which is that, you know, we all know that the governor has somewhere around 60 days. I'm skeptical of assigning a 60-day clock to it because lots of things happen in an elastic amount of time at the Capitol. But let's assume that the governor has about 60 days. We're somewhere 3 weeks into that time frame now. At what point does he have to have a plan B? At what point, where is it, and what is, does he have a plan B in your sense? No, Anthony's shaking your head, no. But like even about going around Republicans in the legislature to get the taxes on the ballot without them, at what point does he have to say, look, I'm not going to let the whole thing crash without at least trying something different? Or does he let the whole thing crash if they don't come forward?
Well, I don't think that he needs a plan B. I think that the plan that Brown put out last week or a week and a half ago is the blueprint for the next budget. I mean, that is, and Republicans have conceded that point just by the fact that they've acknowledged that they're not going to offer a counterproposal. You talk to Democratic leaders in the legislature, I mean, they will say, hey, look, this is the blueprint. Now, do we tweak this idea of the redevelopment agencies? Is it a 5-year suspension of the property tax revenue instead of an elimination of the agencies? Do you only cut $1 billion instead of eliminating? I mean, those are tweaks around the edges, but the plan that you saw on January 10th, that is the basic blueprint of the budget.
And key to that is the roughly half cuts, half taxes, or half spending reductions revenues.
Right, and so I think the bigger questions are, do other issues come? What does it take to get the Republican votes? Do you need to bring pensions into the discussion? Do you need to, you know, what sort of reforms on things like the California Environmental Quality Act, you know, CEQA? What sort of concessions do you give to the Republicans to get this plan through? But I think that this is, by and large, the plan that will be adopted by the legislature. I mean,
or will not, which.
It will. Whether the taxes are sort of another issue,
right?
But the basic budget blueprint, I think, at least as a first round, I think that basically what you saw Brown propose will be adopted by the legislature.
Yeah. So as we try to figure out what to look for next, I mean, any other thoughts on yours? Ms. Williams, you're always the smart one when you're on. So.
I don't know about that. I think Anthony just laid out, you know, pretty much all the budget discussions. But I don't. He says that he sees movement from some Republicans on this idea of putting taxes on the ballot. I'm skeptical, but maybe if they get what they want, they'd be willing to put them on. I mean, I don't see where you cut that much money out of the budget without the taxes.
Especially, it seems like, too, and the only thing I would say is that there's a big battle going on for framing here, for framing this with the public, framing for not only what the taxes are, the extensions, increases, but also framing the, do we let the voters at least decide versus just telling the voters you don't get to have a chance. I mean, you know, there's a big political framing match going on.
Right, and he's also going to have to, if he does get this on the ballot, have to frame these taxes in a totally different way from the way that Schwarzenegger did just a couple years ago. And I think that's what the discussion about the locals is all about, in saying, look, these are not taxes that are going to go back to Sacramento where we waste money and you don't understand what we do. This is going to be for services in your community. This is going to be programs that you depend upon. So you decide.
Anything you'd like to add to that, oh wise one, Mr. York?
No, nothing to add.
Nothing to add to that. So let's just wrap up with just a couple minutes here, and we'll this will be a short podcast, folks. Again, hey, you know, we're working hard here at the Hotel Shattuck. And so since we never really had a postmortem on the governor's race, I just want to quickly touch on a couple of things. We're sitting here at this conference. First of all, as Juliet said a while ago, the Whitman people boycotted the conference, said they had nothing to add to any of this. But bottom line, I mean, this is not a really complicated race to kind of break down at a certain point, is it? I mean, it came down to some simple themes about character, about what the voters thought they wanted or who they knew. I mean, Do you get that sense when you look back now, the exhaustion we all suffered in all of this? I mean, Julie, I'll start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it came down to who do you trust? Meg Whitman looked too much like Arnold Schwarzenegger, which people had seen him come there, done that. It didn't work out. And I think there's a lot of truth in what some of the panelists are saying, that people were sick of her by the time the general election came around. She'd been spending money for months. She was up on the air. And they didn't buy it.
There was a point, too, in this where I really liked the line from the political consultant who worked with Tom Campbell, who was a Republican candidate for governor at one point, who talked about Meg Whitman renting the voters. And I thought that was a particularly interesting term, about you can rent the voters, but you can't necessarily get them on election day when you need them in the final analysis.
Maybe not in California anyway. But I think, you know, also running as a Republican in California is kind of equivalent to running a ballot measure campaign. You know, it's, you kind of have to thread the needle to get it passed, you know, to vote yes on a Republican. It's much easier to vote no. I mean, the default position in California is to vote Democratic. And all you have to do as a Democratic candidate is cast doubt on the Republican candidate. We saw Gray Davis do it in 2002 with Bill Simon. And we saw Jerry Brown do it clearly with Meg Whitman in 2010. And so, you know, it would be nice to sort of have them atone for their political sins, the Whitman team, this week. But apparently we're not going to get that pound of flesh here this week. So we'll have to seek it out elsewhere.
And I've always told people just quickly that I think that the Whitman campaign's biggest problem was death by a thousand cuts. That I don't know whether, you know, all the things that went wrong for the Whitman campaign, maybe some of them would have been a fatal blow if they had been singular issues. But compiled one after the other on top of everything of the narrative that built up in that race, it became impossible to get around. And so
then the final stake in that was Nikki Diaz, the housekeeper. It was yet another character issue where people couldn't believe her. It just didn't seem like a worthwhile.
Yeah, it was the trust issue, I think, fundamentally. And people felt like they knew Jerry Brown. I mean, he's been around for 40 years. They felt like they knew him. They felt like they could, they might not agree with him, they could generally trust him.
As even the Poisoner people said in this event, that was a brand that nobody could compete with in politics in California.
Although I disagree with that a little bit. I mean, Jerry Brown has lost a couple of general election campaigns in California. You know, the Brown name will buy you a Democratic primary. I mean, that's been tested for the last 40 years. But Jerry Brown lost in 1982 to Pete Wilson. He lost the U.S. Senate race. I mean, the Browns have lost statewide before. But there's nobody who has the stature on the Republican side to compete with that. And so it's sort of a larger issue about the Republican Party in California, that there is no bench, there is no reservoir of experienced political leaders who can bank upon that public trust. And that's, you know, ultimately what Brown capitalized and why he won by 13, 14 points on Election Day.
And before we totally kill the mood here at the bar talking about politics, we'll wrap it up. So let me thank the two very able-minded bar pals here, Juliet Williams from the AP and Anthony York from the Los Angeles Times. I'm John Myers from KQED, and
cheers.
Good.
Just want to let you know we're at a bar. We'll see you next time.